As the coronavirus pandemic continues, we're buying less food from restaurants and more from the grocery store. That's meant headaches and surpluses for farmers as they struggle to meet consumers where they are. Plus, empty restaurants, face masks at the grocery store, shouting to neighbors from a safe social distance. We're living in strange times, and the Illinois State Museum wants your help documenting them. And last month, when libraries closed across Illinois, it meant more than just a loss of reading material. We'll hear about some of the ways that libraries are continuing to try to serve their communities. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up this hour on The 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, and WNIJ in DeKalb. The news is next. Welcome to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. As we go to air Tuesday morning, the Illinois Department of Public Health is reporting a total of just over 22,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Illinois, which includes 794 people who've died from the disease. It's been found in 87 of Illinois' 102 counties. Dr. Ngozi Ezike is director of Illinois' Department of Public Health.
The individuals and the communities impacted by this virus have touched nearly every part of our state. We must stay the course and continue working together to practice physical distancing and stay at home as much as possible. This, along with wearing our masks and washing our hands and cleaning the frequently touched surfaces, are absolutely our best weapons against this virus.
Later this hour, we'll be speaking with Illinoisans who are documenting life during the COVID-19 pandemic for future generations. And we're checking in with how libraries, despite being closed, are adapting to serve their communities. But first, the coronavirus pandemic and changing consumer buying habits have left some grocery store shelves empty, but farmers with a surplus of fresh produce, dairy, and meat. As major consumers of meat and dairy, like restaurants and schools, close their doors, food industry regulators are pushing for new policies and trying to figure out what to do with the surplus supply. Brian Duncan's on the line with me now. He's a hog farmer in Ogle County. That's southwest of Rockford. Brian's also vice president of the Illinois Farm Bureau. Also joining me, I have Regellus Scavuzzo. She's Associate Director of Food Systems Development for the Illinois Farm Bureau. Brian, Regella, welcome to The 21st. Glad to have you with us.
Thanks for having us.
Glad to be here, Brian. Yeah, thanks for having us on today.
And as ever, we invite you to join the conversation. Have your food buying habits changed? Give us a call at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us at 21st Show. Brian, I want to start with you. Can you just begin by telling us a little bit more about your farm?
Yeah, sure, Brian. We're a family farm. My wife and I farm with our son and two daughters are involved in the farming operation. We grow row crops, corn and soybeans. Have a wean-to-finish hog operation. I'm still an independent hog producer. And then we also custom feed cattle for some individuals. So that is that's what my farm looks like.
And, you know, I think when we see the empty shelves in grocery stores, Brian, whether it's in person, as I have, or on social media, at least some of the shelves, if we can't get what we need at the grocery store, I think it contributes to this perception that there is a shortage of food out there. But from your standpoint, that's not really the case, is it?
That's absolutely correct. There's a surplus here on the farm. What we are seeing are logistics problems, supply chain issues, as consumers have changed their eating patterns because of shelter-at-home policies. We've seen a shift in the needs from food service industry, hospitality industries, restaurants, hotels, the like, to a greater demand for food at the retail space and the grocery stores. And not only is the packaging different for retail than it is for food service, but even the the cuts, the type of products that people buy and consume are different through retail. And so that's created a major hiccup, I guess, if you will, for a highly technical term, in the supply chain and the ability for processors to get that product to the grocery stores.
So, Rogella, I want to ask you, when we're talking about the food industry, we're talking about a lot of different things, right? You have farmers like Brian, you have grocery stores, factories, production lines, restaurants, I guess you can count in there. I wonder if that contributes to the disconnect between our perception of how much food is out there and how much is really available.
It does. So there's... there's multiple facets to the food system. And when you start looking at different pieces, every piece has a series of steps that it takes. And so the food that you put on your plate may have had 12 to 15 different steps before it got to your plate. And it's across the industry. So, you know, an onion going to an onion ring at a restaurant is going to be very different than the bag of onions that you're buying in your grocery store. The same goes for eggs. For example, eggs might be liquid eggs in the food service industry. And so that egg industry, that egg producer might be shipping it to a place that turns it into liquid eggs, that cartons it, or to a restaurant, it might go to flats, but into your grocery store, it goes into 12 dozen cartons. All three have different processing facilities, different steps that are required for regulation and how it's all put together. So it's a logistical issue that takes, when you move one step to another, it can't just on the dime turn into the other piece.
So yeah, you can't just, I guess, and that's something that maybe people might not understand is that, you know, that bag of onion or that onion that was destined to be in a ring cannot very easily just be handed off to a grocery store instead.
Yeah. So, you know, for example, carrots at a restaurant, they might be a 50 pound bag of carrots, but in the grocery store, you're going to buy a 2 pound bag. Those are different bags. Those are different washing and sorting and grading pieces. And you have to have different equipment for each piece that does something different. The same thing happens with cheese and butter and cream. So all of the industry, depending on where it's going, could be as much as how it's packaged and the facility that it goes. Restaurants are going to buy 50 pound bags of shredded cheese, but the grocery store wants 8 ounce packages. Those are two different processes in which they go through, and a facility may not be set up for that.
And Rogella, what is your response when you hear that people are worried about food shortage?
It's not that the food's there. It just doesn't neatly take one step to the other, and it takes time for the system to readjust and make those decisions. I know that there's been concerns that things like the food banks, why can't we just donate the product? Well, the same issue faces with them. When you're looking at, you know, the 50 pounds of cheese, somebody has to change that 50 pounds of cheese into consumable amounts for the consumer. And at food banks, it requires volunteers that they may have. The grocery store, it requires different sets of things. But the food's there. It's just a readjustment of our system.
Yeah, I love cheese. We love cheese in our house, but I think 50 pounds would be a lot to deal with. Brian, the coronavirus and everything that came along with it ramped up here in the U.S. in just a matter of weeks, it seems like. Although it, you know, sometimes feels like it's been years, but you know, something like raising livestock does take a lot of preparation, at least months in advance. Brian, how has the timeline of this crisis affected you in terms of your production?
Well, it's creating a bottleneck at the processing side, you know, and like you said, Brian, it was almost a year ago that the plans were laid for the hogs that are going to market today. The adult females are bred. They gestate, the pigs are born, and 6 months later they go to market. So that whole thing takes about a year. And it's a biological system that you just can't pull the plug on. There are, as processing plants have problems with COVID, having employees either ill or not coming to work, they slow down what they're capable of handling. And then that slows down the pigs they can take from me on the farm, which then backs up my facilities that have to take the new pigs that are being born. I mean, it is really a just-in-time delivery system, and it runs at max capacity most of the time, so there's not a lot of room for backing the system up. There just isn't time, and like my facilities, not only are they emptied and loaded with the next set of pigs coming, but we need to have time to wash, disinfect in between each set of pigs. The barns are made spotless and completely disinfected, and that takes time as well. So you are really, if you want to think about a system as a chain moving through a bunch of gears, it's flowing through the gears here, and COVID-19 has just put a screwdriver in the gear. I mean, things just come to a halt, but the back gears keep moving, and it just keeps pushing product where right now it's very hard to move it on down through the system.
So what happens to your pigs?
Well, that's a great question. So this is a first for me, right? So we're working through it with the processors who we deliver pigs to. We are changing diets up to slow the growth of the pigs. We are looking at maybe double loading some facilities until we get the next facility empty. There's all sorts of strategic, creative things going on that I don't know if will work or not, but we're sure going to try.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The 21st. We're talking about how the coronavirus has affected the food and production landscape here in Illinois with Brian Duncan. He's a hog farmer in Ogle County. And Rogella Scavuzzo, she's Associate Director of Food Systems Development for the Illinois Farm Bureau. As a reminder, you can always join the conversation. Have you felt worried about being able to get enough food? Give us a call, 800-222-9455, or you can tweet us at 21st Show. Rogella, yesterday we were speaking with Brent Schwer, who's the owner of Ingrained Restaurant and Brewery in Springfield, and he said he's still having to figure out how to navigate this situation as a restaurant owner. And I wonder, how has the restaurant industry as a whole been affected? How do they connect to producers?
So the restaurant industry has been a dramatic shift both for the producers and the farms. Brent is one of those examples that buys from local farms, and they plan out their ordering ahead of time. And if he's unable to place those orders, those farms no longer have the outlet that they had planted with in mind. And you're seeing restaurants try and shift with this. You're seeing curbside pickups, and you're seeing delivery options. But not all of these businesses were set up for that. Most restaurants weren't designed to just be a grab-and-go business. So they're having to shift how they function. You're seeing limited menus. You're seeing to-go. But you're also seeing a change in their staffing. They can't have as many people working, but they're trying to support their staff. And you're seeing limited hours or online ordering. And we're seeing e-commerce pop up both for restaurants and farms as an alternative option to try and connect with those consumers, reduce the exchange of cash, and really have an opportunity to reach a broader audience.
So in 2018, I think Americans spent more on food from full service and fast food restaurants, $678 billion, compared to the $627 billion spent at grocery stores. So more at restaurants than grocery stores. That's according to USDA data. And now the National Restaurant Association is saying they expect the industry is going to lose hundreds of billions of dollars over the next few months, millions of jobs. So let's talk about, what are some solutions we can get to? And we're also seeing farmers having to dump products, like 5% of the country's milk supply is being dumped, apparently. Brian, I wonder, what kind of things do we need to do for farmers like yourself from the federal government right now?
Well, I think there's a couple things, Brian, and you bring up the dumping of product, and that's where we're at until we get this economy moving again. And so I think what the federal government can do and state governments as well. And before I say this, I want to stress that I understand there are people, and this is a horrible virus, and there are parts of the country that have experienced terrible things, and my heart goes out for those that are suffering. And so I want to lay that out first, but yet as we look forward, that's, I think, what we need to do is to look forward and have a constructive, cohesive plan for how we open things up, because there are areas of this country that could perhaps begin a journey back to life as normal. I don't know what that looks like. I don't know how we go about opening things up, but I think those are discussions that we need to start having so we can provide an atmosphere of some certainty for farmers and for markets, because right now everything's very uncertain, and markets do not like uncertainty, and we've seen commodity markets fall pretty much by 40% across the board. So that's, I think that's step one. Step two is there's going to need to be some financial aid going out to farmers to help them span this gap here when the economy has been shut down. We're going to need agriculture on the backside of this. We're going to need production. I mean, those hogs were going places prior to this. The milk was being consumed through schools, mm-hmm. and we don't want to come through this with a completely devastated food sector. And same way with biofuels and the energy sector that agriculture provides. We need it healthy on the backside of this. And so I think there's going to need to be direct aid, loans for farmers, mm-hmm. Low interest type of a way to bridge this gap right now.
Well, there's so much more about this topic we could talk about, but I'm afraid we have to leave it there. That's Brian Duncan. He's a hog farmer in Ogle County, southwest of Rockford. He's also vice president of the Illinois Farm Bureau. We also spoke with Rogella Scavuzzo, associate director of food systems development for the Illinois Farm Bureau. Brian, Rogella, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us about this today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Coming up after the break, we'll be speaking with some of the people around Illinois who are documenting life during the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm Brian Mackey. Stay close. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. For 150 years, Busey has helped business owners and entrepreneurs navigate financial decisions, achieve long-term goals, and realize dreams of success. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We are living in a surreal time because of the coronavirus pandemic. Schools are virtual, businesses closed, and once obscure public health terms like social distancing have become part of our daily lives and habits. The Illinois State Museum is collecting COVID-19 stories to preserve this history unfolding before our eyes for future generations, but also to give people a sense of connection now. Erica Holst is curator of history at the Illinois State Museum in Springfield and joins us now to talk about the Collecting COVID-19 initiative. Erica, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
I'm also joined by two photographers who've been documenting life during the pandemic in their Illinois towns. Ellen McDowell turned her hobby of daily nature photographs into portraits of families during the pandemic. She's been taking porch portraits of Galesburg residents in front of their homes and sharing them on social media. Ellen, welcome to the show.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
And Bob Myers also joins us. He's from DeKalb. He's drone pilot as well as a photographer, and he's been taking photos recently of everything from school lunch distributions to tents in hospital parking lots. Bob, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, glad to be here.
And we want to know if you've been preserving your pandemic experiences for posterity. Let us know, 800-222-9455. The number again is 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us at 21st Show. Erica, I want to start with you. Can you tell us what sort of stories and objects the Illinois State Museum is collecting?
Well, we're casting a wide net. We're asking for anything and everything. We purposely made our call broad. We said, send us anything. Writings, artwork, your personal narrative, photographs, and we've gotten a little bit of everything. The response has really been kind of incredible, and it's just whatever speaks to people and you know, whatever medium allows people to process what they're going through and what the world around them looks like, they've been sending in.
Is there anything, particular submission that's stuck with you as maybe a little more on the unusual side or anything like that?
Oh my gosh, we've seen people doing haikus set to memes. Someone wrote a children's story. Someone did short films that they sent us the YouTube link for. Poetry, artwork, just sitting down and typing out what's in their heart. People have really been creative.
I'm trying to imagine what the museum goer in 2120 is going to see, what sort of objects. And, I got to think like the toilet paper roll might be figure prominently in this display. Has anyone sent in any toilet paper or masks or gloves or anything like that?
A lot of pictures of masks. We've got a picture of toilet paper cakes that were at the local grocery store. They didn't have toilet paper on the shelves, but they did bake cakes into the shapes of toilet paper. So that one is funny.
That is amazing. Okay. Eric, I wonder what inspired the museum to start this collection of COVID-19 related material?
Well, so when we started, we were thinking long term that we want to preserve this for posterity, because one thing that typically survives in a historical event like this is the numbers. You know, at the end of this, we're going to know the numbers of people who are unemployed. We're going to know the numbers of people who sadly became ill and passed away. But something that often escapes history is the human experience. You know, what did those numbers mean to the people who are experiencing illness, who are experiencing loss or job loss, or just the fact that everybody's world changed? So we put out this call to kind of collect those experiences and save them for the long term. But what we quickly realized is that giving people a forum to process things in the short term is very helpful too. You know, acknowledging that we're all going through something and your experience is valid and we want to hear it. And then being able to share it back through our social media and showing people, you know, this is, you're not alone. We're all coping. And these are some ways that people are coping. And these are some ways people are getting through, I think, is helping to kind of build a sense of community.
And we want to get to a little more about that later. But I want to bring Ellen into the conversation at this point. Ellen, you've taken, as I understand it, more than 65 of these porch portraits. These are families in the Galesburg area during the pandemic. Can you describe some of your portraits for us?
Well, I come from a nature portrait background, so doing people was something very new to me, but I really miss human interaction, and I kind of do not want to feel alone with what's going on now. And the response was amazing when I put the Facebook post out to see if anybody wanted to play along with me on this. Talking to people, sharing those intimate moments in their front yards, on their porch, just feeling like you're connected. I think it's really important.
So for those of us, as most of our listeners will be on the radio, what are we looking at? Are these sort of American Gothic type images? What do we see when we look at some of these pictures?
The creativity I left up to people. Some people use signs and talked about their heroes and staying home. Some people just celebrated spring with me. Some people on the spur of the moment just grabbed their families and sat together and smiled. It was a really unique experience.
And what inspired you to start doing this?
On Facebook, I saw a photographer friend in Colorado who literally took pictures of his neighbors on their porches, and it was funny. And I thought, well, I could do something like that here. I live in the country, so I'd have to venture into town at a safe distance. But it brought me closer to people, and I got to meet new people. It was just incredible.
Bob, I want to ask you same question, basically. Why did you decide to start documenting this time in the DeKalb area?
Well, I have to give credit where credit's due. My wife is Sue Breeze. She's the DeKalb County historian, and this was all her idea. She suggested that I start going out and getting pictures of the local area and things that are going on because of the virus. And I'm quite active with Facebook also, and so I put out the call to a lot of my friends to send some of their pictures. So I'm up to about 170 pictures of, you know, the area, empty parking lots, school lots that are usually cram-packed full of cars are empty. Some of the schools are handing out free lunches now, you know, just all kinds of local stuff like that.
And Bob, was there a particular moment that you captured or decided to capture when you thought, wow, the surrealness of this time we're living through really, really struck you?
Well, I had a drone up Sunday morning, Easter, and there's three churches right here in town. The biggest churches in town, they're all like in the same block. And I got a view of all three of their parking lots with the drone, and there's not a single car in any of the lots. And, you know, Easter is like the big Sunday for, you know, everybody to go to church, and there was nobody at any of these churches, and that really kind of caught me.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The 21st. Our guests have all been documenting life in Illinois during the COVID-19 pandemic in different ways. I'm joined by Erica Holst, curator at the Illinois State Museum, along with Ellen McDowell and Bob Myers, who've been photographing in their communities. You can also join the conversation. If you have any stories from past crises, whether a pandemic or something else, you can share with us at 800-222-9455. That number again is 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us at 21st Show. Erica, where is the COVID-19 collection at the Illinois State Museum currently displayed? I gather the museum is closed now.
So we're collecting digitally, and so we're preserving. We're going to preserve for the long term and save for future generations. Once we can get back into the office and start working, we're all working from home now, but once we can get back to our desks, we plan to display it on the Illinois Digital Archives. And in the meantime, we're kind of sharing what we get in the form of social media posts or little mini online exhibits. And then our hope is that someday when, you know, we can all gather and groups larger than 50 again, and there's a vaccine, then we'd like to have a show and put them up for people to see in the exhibit and bring everyone out to celebrate life.
And Erica, how do you think these objects and the art that's been captured now during the pandemic, I mean, is this something that will eventually make it into a physical display in a museum, you know, years down the line, do you think?
We hope so. So one thing we've asked on our online submission is, would you be willing to donate the real life version to the museum? Mm-hmm. And so again, when we're back at work and back at our desks and can see people and touch objects again, we've planned to follow up and ask people to donate their artwork or their objects or their photos for our physical collection. And yes, undoubtedly, that'll make it into some kind of physical display at some point.
And Bob, what about you? Do you, when you're taking your photographs, do you think about future generations? Do you hope that they will be viewed by future generations as you're, as I said, documenting life in the DeKalb area during the pandemic?
Yeah, I do. Right now I'm storing all the images on my computer, but I hope to get them organized with captions of what they are, if it's not obvious, you know. And all my pictures will be going to the Joyner History Room in Sycamore, at which time I hope we'll have some kind of a display that, you know, can be viewed maybe either online or actually there in person at the Joyner History Room.
And what about you, Ellen? Are you thinking about how future generations might look back on these portraits?
Yeah, I do think of the bigger picture now that I've done it. And, you know, we see a lot of the bad news on TV. We see a lot of empty places. I hope that my portraits allow people to look back on a warm spring day in the midst of it all and feel joy and connection.
You know, and talking about future generations and looking back, we actually have some audio here of a man named Stephen Black talking about his grandfather's experience as a doctor during the 1918 flu pandemic.
He talked about going out in the, I think it was 1918, when they had the major flu epidemic in the country, and he was gone for days at a time, and the people would leave him sandwiches in their mailboxes because they knew he didn't have any food. So when he was going by with his horse and buggy, he would be able to pick up something to eat in the mailboxes.
Oh, wow.
And he'd go out and set up with people, you know, 2 and 3 days at a time when they were sick. You know, you can't imagine that today, but he would spend, you know, days sitting with someone who was very ill.
That audio is from the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library Oral History Collection. It was recorded in 2008. It kind of reminds me of how you hear stories of people helping healthcare workers now, sending meals, sponsoring meals for healthcare workers. Of course, pandemics can also have a lot of incredibly sad moments, tragedies. Here's Jacqueline Jackson speaking in 2008 about the flu pandemic in Illinois again and what her family told her about it.
I heard from Eloise, who lived down the road from us when we were talking about things, and I mentioned Dad saying how the Lowell Putney family had died. She said, well, she said, we had a sort of a memorial service out at our house. She said, after the flu was over, she said, I can remember my mother saying, oh, what a bitter, bitter pill that was. And they got everybody together to remember the Putney family, because there wasn't any family to remember them because they were all dead.
So, Erica, you're curator of history at the Illinois State Museum. I wonder if there's another time in history. Obviously, we just heard some tape from the flu or about the flu pandemic. But is there another time in history where you're seeing parallels to the moment we're living in?
You know, I think each of the world wars is similar. And, you know, the parallel has already been drawn that we need to kind of treat this like we're mobilizing for war. But when production ramps up and is all directed towards the war effort, you know, everything now is going towards PPE and getting the doctors the supplies they need. And also the sense of nobody being untouched, you know, a global phenomenon that's hitting everyone, I think, is similar to a wartime scenario.
And I guess in that vein, so I mean, we've been talking a lot about future generations and what they might make of this material, but do you hope that the, you know, collecting this information, Erica, can kind of draw people together now, maybe help mobilize people for this fight that we're in, if you want to call it that?
Absolutely. And I think one of the most wonderful things that has come up is the submissions we're getting and the portraits and photographs that your other guests are taking are really sort of a mirror of society. And when you look in that mirror, you see this beautiful resilience of the human spirit. You know, we're in this crisis moment where people are suffering and our way of life has changed. And you see people, despite physical distance, reaching out and trying to connect and trying to help and stay close and, you know, being strong, maybe being stronger than they ever thought they had to be. And so it's inspiring. And I hope that other people are inspired and, you know, are proud of themselves and find strength within themselves.
And Ellen, just about a minute left here in our segment, but I wonder, you mentioned earlier, I think, that this is a form of connection for you now. I mean, have you been getting feedback from people in Galesburg about your portraits?
Yeah, I definitely have. People that have been in them, people that haven't been in them. The Register Mail did a lovely story on it that invited so many other people to join. I guess I have a lot of porch portraits to take here in the near future. It just reminds me of a time maybe before social media, ironically, that I'm using social media, when people just sat around and talked. And there are so many horrible things going on right now with this pandemic. Maybe we all just need to connect in those little joyful moments.
Yeah, there's something ironic about a pandemic that is making us stay distant, somehow bringing people closer together. We've been talking with Ellen McDowell. She's been taking portraits of Galesburg residents in front of their homes and sharing them on social media. We also heard from Bob Myers, who's a DeKalb area photographer, drone pilot, and Erica Holst, who's curator of history at the Illinois State Museum in Springfield. All of you, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Coming up after the break, we're going to be hearing how libraries are creating more online resources for patrons who can no longer come to the library in person. We want to know, what does your local library mean to you? Have they adapted during these closures? Give us a call, 800-222-9455. That number again is 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us at 21st Show. That's coming up on the 21st. Stay with us. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Concerns over the coronavirus pandemic forced the closure of both public and school libraries across Illinois last month. For many, closed libraries mean more than just a loss of reading material for local communities. It can also mean a loss of shelter, safety, or even just productivity. But closed doors do not mean that libraries have stopped serving their patrons. We're joined on the line now by Jeannie Hamilton. She's the library director for the Bloomington Public Library. Jeannie, welcome back to The 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
As ever, we invite you to join the conversation. What does your local library mean to you? How have they adapted during these closures? Give us a call, 800-222-9455. That number is 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us at 21st Show. Jeannie, what sort of services besides just books does the library provide for people?
Well, right now, we are really focusing on our online resources. We do still have books, the ebooks and e-audiobooks, even e-comics and graphic novels, and e-magazines that a lot of people are excited about those. And then a lot of online digital resources as well. Things that maybe you can learn about some new topics while we're not in the building.
Yeah. Well, but in the before times, though, as some people are taking to calling it, it's a lot more than even just materials, whether digital or text. I mean, there are computers and childcare in a sense, right? I mean, libraries have become so much more than books and movies and things.
Absolutely. So yeah, one of the things that we are definitely missing a lot right now is our programs. We offer many, many programs each year. And so we are adapting a little bit. We are trying to offer some of those programs virtually, providing those through both Facebook and YouTube. And I know some of our librarians have some story times out there. Some other libraries have also, I saw a virtual escape room even, so you can work your way out of a room online.
Yeah. I guess what I'm wondering, though, is I think that libraries have become community centers in a way, right? I mean, for some people,
absolutely,
it's a place to use. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. We see typically 1,000 people a day come through our doors. So that's something that's really a big change for us, not being able to see those friendly faces. And that's something that I know staff has had a challenge adapting to, that we're not seeing the people and offering. Sometimes we're the only people see in a day. So maybe someone isn't able to get out of their house much, but they are able to come to the library and see a friendly face. So absolutely, that's something that something that isn't able to easily be replaced online.
And I mean, thinking of those vulnerable communities, I think, that use the library a lot or rely on the library, the elderly, kids, even the homeless. I wonder if that was a consideration in terms of having to close, you know, this idea that libraries help keep people safe. And what sort of changes you and your staff might have had to make before the stay-at-home order was in effect.
Sure. One thing, I mean, it is a blessing that it's not freezing cold temperatures, because that is something that we do offer heat to people sometimes. And so we are having at least some nice weather. So I am happy that if it could be any time of year, this is a decent time of year for that purpose. But before we closed, we did do we reduced our services and offered curbside pickup. And so we allowed people to place holds and they could drive up and pick up items. And through our conversations with that, originally we were only going to allow drive-ups because we thought maybe that was a little bit safer with a barrier. But we really had staff advocating for a spot where we could safely let people walk up as well, because we do have a lot of walkers and people who use public transportation to get to the library. So we were able to adapt and still safely offer that service to people who could walk up. Then once the stay at home order came into place, we felt like we had to stop that curbside service. But we did, we still offer Wi-Fi in our parking lot 24 hours a day. Typically that would be something that we only offer during operating hours, but we've expanded that for those people who maybe don't have internet at home.
Hmm. So they can drive up, park, or I guess sit on the lawn or park in the parking lot and access the internet that way if they need to.
Yes, absolutely.
So when you heard about the closing, you know, down orders, the stay at home orders, what were you hearing from patrons at that time?
You know, at that point we had, so that order came on a Friday afternoon for the next Saturday, and we had, our last day that we were open was that Monday. So 4 days earlier. And we had been doing curbside service for that week. And we just were hearing a lot of people that were grateful that we were able to do that for them. It was, you know, many people saw kind of the writing on the wall that places were starting to reduce services and potentially shut down. And so they appreciated that, that they could get that last bit in before they knew that they might be home for a while.
Yeah. We're speaking with Jeannie Hamilton. She's the library director for the Bloomington Public Library about what libraries are doing in this time of pandemic. So Jeannie, you talked a little bit about this earlier, but you know, now that libraries are closed and trying to adapt and figure out different ways to serve their communities, what does that look like in Bloomington?
So we are, we have a lot of online resources that we are happy to provide. And I think across the state, even smaller libraries that maybe don't have quite as many resources at the tips of their fingers, even they are having able to provide ebooks and e-magazines. But some of the things that I've been really excited to see is vendors have really been working with us as well. For example, Ancestry, they usually restrict access to just in the library, and that's a genealogy tool, and they've opened that up so people can access that at home through our website now. So maybe people have a little bit extra time on their hands so they can do a little genealogy project and see what their ancestors were doing. Maybe even their ancestors were impacted by different pandemics in the past, like the 1918 flu. So you could kind of see what your family has been through in the past.
Yeah. I wonder if it's, I mean, if there's even sort of a small positive in all this, and that it's kind of forced libraries to figure out some digital alternatives. You know, on March 24th, the Internet Archive, which is, I guess, not necessarily a library in the way we traditionally think of it, but it announced it was creating a national emergency library by suspending waitlists for the 1.4 million books in its digital lending library. And the organization says that suspension will remain in place until June 30th or the end of the U.S. national emergency, whichever's later. I wonder, you mentioned the genealogy tool. Is there more of a push to move digital now?
I think, you know, we've been in the digital world for a long time. The Bloomington Library has had ebooks available since 2006. So I think we've really been kind of doing a balancing act where we've offered a lot of digital, but a lot of in-person too. So we were in a good position going into this. We didn't have to scramble to do a lot, but we did speed up some of the things that we had already planned launching. So for example, in Bloomington, we were going to launch automatic renewals for eligible items. So if no one's waiting on an item, it would just automatically renew. So sometimes people forget to go in and renew an item or call us and renew an item, and this will greatly reduce fines due to those just forgotten moments. And so we were going to launch that with National Library Week, which is coming up next week, but we launched that a month early because of this. So that was exciting to be able to do. Another thing that we had kind of waiting in the wings were some mobile hotspots that we were going to check out to people, and we were able to launch those during our curbside pickup. So we were able to get 14 of those out into the hands of the community. And one person in particular that picked theirs up was so appreciative because she said she could now do her job from home. So stories like that were the, there are some silver linings that we were pushed to maybe move quicker on some things that we had had waiting in the wings.
You know, you mentioned automatic renewals, and there has been a lot of talk in the past about how eliminating library fines can be help address some social inequities. Does that, is that part of the decision making that went into that?
Yeah, absolutely. So at last April, a year ago, we switched over to a new checkout system. And at that time, we wiped any fines that were existing at that moment. We did go ahead and re-implement the fine policies after that, but we have been making, you know, kind of small steps, trying the testing the water, so to speak, with those types of moves. And so this automatic renewals was our next move in that direction, to just try to really make things more equitable and help people. We all have busy lives, and so trying to meet people where they're at.
And I wonder, the coronavirus pandemic is obviously posing a lot of financial challenges to our country, our state, our economy. Once this is over and we get back to our new normal, are you worried that an economic recession could mean patronage surges, but there are fewer resources available to the library? Do you have concerns about the next few months or the next few years?
You know, we unfortunately have been through a recession not too long ago, and so we have weathered this before. We do certainly see a big boost in library usage during times of tough economies, and that piece is exciting, to be able to help people in need and help provide entertainment, especially entertainment that we think is very helpful in building life skills too. And we are primarily property tax based, so that does create somewhat of a stable funding for us. But yes, if property values decrease, then we'll see a decrease in funds. We have a staff that's very good about being frugal, and so we'll certainly look at spending, and as our funds get tighter, we just try to be more and more creative about what we can do. Sometimes that means maybe we'll do in more in-house programming instead of bringing programs from outsiders in, or we might have to try to reduce anywhere that we can find ways without, we always try to be strategic and not impact services as little as possible, while still making things work.
And the last thing I want to ask you about in a little less than a minute remaining, but is there anything you want the public to know about what you're having to navigate right now?
We're so grateful for the comments that we're getting from people that are just so encouraging. They appreciate all that we're doing. It really was hard for libraries across the country to make this decision to close, because by nature, we really want to help people. But we have to balance that with doing our part to keep people safe during this public health crisis. So we appreciate all the support and positive comments that we've gotten. And we really enjoy serving you in this new way too.
Jeannie Hamilton is the library director for the Bloomington Public Library. She joined us by Zoom chat, as so many people are doing nowadays. Jeannie, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Coming up on tomorrow's 21st, a conversation with Illinois Comptroller Susana Mendoza about being the person responsible for paying the state's bills in a time of crisis and the Wild West atmosphere in procuring things like masks for healthcare workers. That is all the time we have for today's 21st. You can stay up to date with us on Twitter. Just search for 21st Show. That's 21st Show. We tweet out links with more analysis and background about what we've been talking about. You can also subscribe to our podcasts pretty much anywhere you can get a podcast. Apple, Spotify, NPR One. Just search for The 21st. Our program is produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey. Eunice Alpison is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Mackey. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.